which would take, I think, about 16 hours, and you'd still only be one third of the way, because the rest of the way there are no roads.
Wow, and that borders Hudson Bay, probably.
No, yeah. You can't even get to Hudson Bay. That's what I mean. Like, the road would get you halfway to Hudson's Bay.
Wow.
And Hudson's Bay is still nowhere near the north part of the province.
Wow.
They have ice roads for 4 weeks of the year where you could drive up to those remote native communities. And I've been to one that's on the west coast of James Bay, which is just south of Hudson's Bay. It's part of the same body of water. And it was minus 50. And it was March, because that was the only time we could get there.
Wow. Okay, I definitely retract the far north. I'm not even sure you count as the middle. I'd say the lower north.
Do you know even where we are? Well, more so me in Toronto than Jesse in Ottawa, but in southwestern Ontario, we are actually further south than places like North Dakota and Montana and stuff like that, because we cut down below the 48th parallel or whatever it is.
What I find interesting is, like, where is that, you know, are you guys on the same parallel as, like, Edinburgh or, like, Edinburgh or maybe Dublin or, you know, London? Hell, I don't, you know, because...
I think London is maybe where I am, and it's north of where Mark is, but I think Edinburgh is still quite a bit north from where we are.
Yeah, yeah.
But because they're an island, it's a little more moderate weather compared to here, where it's just fucking crazy up there.
Right, right. Yeah, I know the Gulf Stream is like makes the UK inhabitable. That's it. It boils down to that. Yeah, well, we're on the same latitude as Mexico City or something like that.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Most point of the American Empire.
I'm just going to quickly reload my browser. One sec.
Okay.
So I might as well do a quick intro because I've just been testing. Mark Jeftovic here with Access of Easy Salon number 14 with Charles Hugh Smith, Jesse Hirsch, and myself. And we are recording this on...
some July. Day and some month in the middle of a pandemic.
July 23rd.
Well, I think you guys have both been writing about major topics. The Cantillon effect, or since he was born in Ireland, we can say Cantillon. And the boss, meet the new boss, worse than the old boss, your algorithm.
You know, one of the things I didn't put in the email when we were sort of talking about this, but Jesse's been writing a fair bit on it also, is TikTok and the TikTok ban. And one of the things, as I was kind of making a quick note, well, you know what, we'll get to that. So that was just one thing I thought I would kind of like throw onto the stack, as the programmers say. Jesse, what's on
your
mind?
I want to talk about Portland.
You want to talk about Portland? I will admit right now, I am really out of the loop on Portland. All I know is that it's kind of bedlam.
Well, I wouldn't say bedlam, but I think Portland, my line was it's the canary in the coal mine. But I think what's happening in Portland is already happening in other cities across the United States, or will happen in other cities in the United States. And it offers an interesting glimpse into where we may be headed in the weeks and months to come.
Now, the Shaz Autonomous Zone was not Portland. It was Seattle?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And just my quick point is to contextualize that Portland is considered a pretty laid-back city. In other words, it doesn't have a reputation historically for having, you know, a sort of radical... social kind of mentality or zeitgeist, right? So for things to be happening in Portland is in itself extreme. That the fact that there's anything newsworthy other than, you know, it's raining or, you know, we have really great scenery or whatever, you know, the kind of things that Portland is known for. brew pubs, you know, laid back scene.
Yeah. If the HBO show Portlandia taught me anything, there are certainly some quirky characters in Portland.
Well, one last topic on the stack for me is self-organizing alternatives to institutions that are failing. And in the U.S., the number one is education, as everybody mm-hmm. here struggles to try to figure out how their local school board and Department of Education is going to deal with the pandemic and yet somehow like return to some semblance of normality. And some people are just opting out of the whole thing, realizing there's just no way. You're not going to make this work with, you know, half-time students or, you know, one day in school, one day at home. And then how are parents who have jobs, how are they supposed to deal with that? You know, it's just impossible. So that's, I think, a very good topic.
I'm inclined to start with that one, because what I like about it is both its symbolic power of being representative of the crisis of institutions that we're seeing in almost every sector, but also the conflating of ideas, because the issue of education is not just about education. It's fundamentally about daycare. And it's about what do we do with our kids during the day so that we can go to work, so we can make money and the economy can get going again. And that's what strikes me as so significant about the education issue, is it's not just symbolic, I think, because all institutions in my various view are failing to adapt to the pandemic and to the political economic crisis induced. But it's never a simple issue. It's always complicated. It's always a Venn diagram with multiple things overlapping. And the more we try to simplify it, the more we fail to understand what's really at work here. Because on the one hand, I feel that institutional education as we know it is either severe mortal risk or it's done and people are just in denial. And I've always been a bit of a Timothy Leary tune in, turn on, drop out, and have generally encouraged people to stay away from institutionalized education. But I almost feel that what used to be a radical position is now actually starting to become more widespread. And more people are seeing through the myth of education, especially post-secondary education, where these schools are trying to charge the same fees they used to for what is arguably an inferior product now, especially given the total lack of preparedness for distance education or online learning. But this daycare issue, I feel, is fundamental. That there are a whole bunch of parents, especially moms, who have been totally sabotaged by this pandemic and have incredible difficulties doing their job at home when the kid is also at home and not engaged. And that, I think, is a broader socioeconomic issue of wanting our workforce to be productive. And we've been always using school as a surrogate for daycare and childcare. And maybe that was a mistake, which we're now really seeing at a large scale.
This could really eat up the whole episode because it's such a multifaceted thing. And I will just, like, it kind of, as a parent, right, of a teenage daughter who's, you know, she's like entering high school and heading towards university. Charles, do you have kids? I can't remember if you've...
No. Just okay. I've been close to, you know, nieces and, okay. You know, friends' kids. I've been engaged with kids, okay. But no, none of my own.
So as a parent, right, I find myself in this kind of double bind where somewhere along the line, well, I probably, you know, my daughter has just like internalized the fact that when high school's done, she's going to university and she's going to, you know, do something. And sometimes she stresses because she doesn't know what she's going to major in. And as a responsible parent, I'm supposed to be like, yeah, study hard and, you know, you've got time and think about this and take this all seriously. But as a parent who's lived in the real world for most of my adult life, I have to just kind of like, nobody gives a shit about your university education, right? Like, nobody's going to care. Here's a laptop, right? Start learning React. Start learning a spreadsheet. Start coding, right? I employ 20 people. I've never asked anyone where they went to school, not a single person. You know, but you can't say that to your teenage daughter, especially if you would want to live within the same residence as your wife, right? Because you'll be sent packing. So it's this whole sort of, you know, this path that is just so ingrained into the structure of family and career path, and then the whole, well, I'm kind of losing my train of thought, so I'm going to step back here and just say the daycare thing I've noticed right from the word go, because you would be going to school, you'd be dropping your kid off, and there's a bunch of kids rolling around coughing and snotting all over the place, and you know that their parents are just putting them there because they've got to get to work and they've got to do the job, and so they send their kids to school sick. Kind of benign, it happens, kids love to share these things, but now, coronavirus, whole new ball game with even that etiquette and doing something like that. And whether the kids are even going back to school. Right now, my daughter's school is the only one I know that's actually going back in September with smaller class sizes and stuff. But every other parent I know, their kids are doing remote so far.
Yeah, well, let me unpack a few more topics in, as Jesse said, complexity here. You know, 15 years ago when I started my blog, one of the first things I wanted to talk about was the factory model of education. You know, in other words, it's like literally like a factory. We're going to put all these, you know, people, workers or students or whatever, cram them into a facility, and then they're going to all be treated equally, right? Like they're just, the stamping machine is going to produce, you know, the same education in every one of these individuals, and they're going to be therefore ready for life in corporate America or a government agency where they take orders, they can function in an organizational setting, blah, 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 right? That's the whole model. And then as Jesse was pointing out, that fits in with the whole factory model of the economy, which is we're going to aggregate huge numbers of people in these giant buildings, whether it's an IBM building or an Amazon warehouse or, you know, a Cisco systems, you know, coding farm, whatever it is, we're going to cram a bunch of people into one spot and we're going to put them in a hierarchy. And so the whole idea that this is this whole hierarchical centralized factory model is failing or is no longer functioning, well, then that's the decentralization game we've talked about. The other point I want to bring up is the people that I personally know who are engaged in this decentralized workaround where, you know, a half dozen upper middle class families are going to find a tutor and they're going to bring all the kids together into one spot and have like a mini school, right? With a, you know, semi-professional adult who's going to, you know, kind of incorporate the curriculum that the students are supposed to be learning in their schools, but maybe add some, you know, personal, you know, training or, you know, the oomph factor, like actual attention from an adult, right? Which you're not going to get in remote learning. And some of my friends' kids are saying it's so hit or miss, because this is the other thing, right? Some teachers are just clueless. You know, they're not giving you any feedback at all, no help at all online, right? You're just like tossed out there. And the curriculum's kind of, you know, half measures, and then other teachers are making a better effort. So there's that. I guess I wanted to introduce the idea that it's just such a hit or miss process the way it is now, and so that the centralized control has been lost. You know, in other words, it's like it's just the confetti's been thrown, and you know, let's hope you get a handful. You know, like that. The last thing is inequality, right? If you're a janitor and you have to show up for work, right? Or you work at the water treatment plant or whatever. Number one, you're not going to be in the circle of knowing how to hire a tutor. That's not in your social capital network, right? And number, you know, then also you may not have the free money that the upper middle class has. So then we're going to see an acceleration in yet another field of inequality, right? That, well, my kid got a professional tutor, you know, like somebody that just graduated from college and blah, blah, and your kid is playing watching TikTok at home instead of doing his remote viewing, you know? And so it's sad, but I don't see any way around that inequality.
But I think that's a very powerful point, because if you look at the research around the concept of the digital divide, which originally the digital divide focused on access. It looked at how certain communities didn't get the same level of internet access as others. And while that is tragically still true, that digital divide is actually being bridged. But then they realized that the second digital divide is what you did with that access. And what they found was this remarkable dichotomy between people who lived in high socioeconomic status neighborhoods and households, and they would use internet access for education, versus people who lived in low socioeconomic neighborhoods and households, they would use internet access for entertainment, which is kind of understandable, given that if your life is already kind of rough, the time you spend online, you want to be distracted. You want to forget. You want to have a release. Versus if your life's doing pretty good and stable and in your loving environment, well, then you're going to use that access to fuel your mind, to do education. And, you know, that research really focused on how to bridge that divide. But what I heard when you were sort of discussing that, Charles, was the way in which this pandemic not only exacerbates internet access in terms of those of us who have crappy access and who have difficulty keeping up, but I think it's also going to exacerbate the what you do with that access. To your point that people with high levels of socioeconomic status are going to double down on private education. They're going to double down on self-education and really use this as an opportunity to upgrade their knowledge versus everyone else. They're just struggling to get through the day and not get sick, right? And try to keep your job by showing up even though there's a risk of being sick. So I think absolutely we're going to see that become even more. The other dynamic I was thinking about, sort of pointing out some of the struggles, especially the labor struggles, I suspect we're going to see a lot of teachers revolt come the fall, either because they're being forced to go to school that they don't want to go to for reasons of health, or because they're being forced to do online education without the resources, without the training, without the proper support. And I suspect at a certain point, many teachers in certain jurisdictions are just going to say no, they're just going to go on strike. And part of that will depend upon the larger political climate. But that's why I think Portland is particularly interesting and relevant, both for its symbolism, but also for the way in which this revolt in the United States is starting to spread. Now, Portland, amongst a handful of other cities, has not stopped protesting. Ever since first protests in response to George Floyd's death, Portland every single night has had protests. And for the most part, the entire community, I shouldn't say the entire community, a plurality of the community have supported these protests, including the mayor, including a lot of city officials, and to a certain extent, even the city police. Right, that the city police in Portland have not engaged in the same level of violence or in the same level of response. So the White House has sent to Portland a military force, which has been identified as the Department of Homeland Security, an elite border task force, but it's not clear whether it is exclusively that unit or whether it's a range of people from the Department of Homeland Security. But the point is, they're not identifying themselves. They don't wear identifying information. They're arbitrarily detained and snatching people in the streets, and they're engaging in wholesale violence against protesters and against other people in Portland. To the extent that earlier this week, they pepper sprayed the mayor of Portland, who was there in one of these protests. And it strikes me that this type of indiscriminate police violence and the extent to which the federal government is abusing their authority by going into these communities against the wishes of local government, against the wishes of state government, that's when you really start to provoke people. And that's when people start really standing up and really resisting and really thinking of alternatives. And I raise this in the context of education, because in my very modest study of labor history, teacher strikes tend to be the most powerful because teachers are able to command a moral high ground that other workers are often denied. And because teachers often have a relationship with children and parents, it's easier for them to get the general public to support their labor actions. So I kind of feel that if we see teachers start to take political action this fall and start to take to the streets, that we get closer and closer to general strikes and general actions because teachers have that kind of moral authority. And in the last 4 years or 3 years of this current administration, there have been statewide teacher strikes throughout the United States that have been incredibly effective at meeting their demands because no one wants to mess with teachers. And that's why I think we have an interesting dissection here, or intersection, between the crisis in education that we're seeing and the growing revolt that's happening in the streets of American cities. You're on mute there, Charles.
Sorry. Mark, are you ready to jump in?
No, you go ahead.
I think that's a very interesting intersection, Jesse. And locally here in the state of Hawaii, the teachers union has already flexed its political power by basically saying, you know what, you guys aren't ready for us yet. You know, we're not opening in early August. And the political powers that be are going to have to listen to them, you know, because Hawaii has a somewhat unique situation where the Department of Education is in fact statewide. It is not a local school board like the vast majority of the U.S. So I think you're absolutely right that the teachers probably are pretty close to feeling like they've had enough already. And they want more say. They want more say about how this is going to work. They don't want to just be, you know, like we're talking about the factory model and the hierarchy. They don't want to be told something that's nonsensical, that's just impractical, and that they're supposed to just, you know, somehow make it work, right? So I also want to mention that, you know, all of us are, you know, used to technology, you guys more than me, although I did buy an original Mac with a low serial number at, for an amazingly huge amount of money. So, you know, we just have tons of equipment laying around, right? All of us, we all have extra laptops, and it's just a matter of how old is the laptop you're using at the moment. Is it, you know, brand new, or is it a couple years old or whatever? And I was talking to one of our cousins here, who's a grandparent who's been watching the kids. And he says that he thinks about a third to a half of all the kids don't have a laptop in the household. And so you can say, oh, well, you know, they're using a smartphone. And it's all like, you really want to do all your remote learning on a smartphone? And so it's like this digital divide plays out where if you're just using it for entertainment and communication, then a smartphone is like what everybody thinks is a computer. They don't even open their computer. They don't own one. What's a desktop, huh? Where those of us who are technophobes or used to it, it's like, well, we want a real screen because we're going to be, you know, scrolling through spreadsheets or whatever. So talk about a digital divide. What do you do with households that don't even have a laptop or a desktop? And there's probably a great number of those because, you know, if you're going to spend $600 on one thing, you can get a very good laptop. In fact, I just bought another, you know, 17-inch laptop for $600. I thought, why not? You know, it's so cheap. It's cheaper than an iPhone. But if you're looking for status, like 99% of the population is, well, then you're going to spend the $600 on and get an iPhone because it has more status than a Samsung, right? Or whatever. So all these things conspire to increase that digital divide that you're talking about. And then I did mention family. That's a whole nother thing. In a mobile, you know, factory model economy, the mobility of the workers is a key source of the means of production, right? You want to move people around without any, you know, friction, right? And that's a key point of production, right? We're going to move the most productive people around as needed, and never mind what happens to them and their families. That's completely secondary. So here, because it's an island, there's a lot more grandparents around. And so therefore, there's more buffer, if you will, for families stuck in this circumstance. But in the average American household, the family members are hundreds of miles away, hundreds of clicks away. And so it's like, well, there's nobody except your friends And, you know, friends are important, definitely. But, you know, they don't have quite that level of buffer that having family around is. So that's a whole nother thing that I consider wrong with the factory model. You know, you basically use Marx's thing of everything dissolves into air to maximize production. And one of the things that gets dissolved is family ties and the buffer that you know, creates for individuals.
The talk that we've been doing today about the digital divide and how that tends to play out along socioeconomic lines reminds me a lot, Charles, of what you've been writing about, you know, the red herring of universal basic income, that people think, the mistaken assumption is that we just have to send people checks and then people are going to transition to this life of leisure. And what you, if I understand you correctly, say is that's not really going to happen. They're going to fall into despair and unhappiness because they don't have any meaning in their life from meaningful work. And I think that is the kind of thing that plays out along the same fault line, right? That the people who have already some socioeconomic means and human capital at their fingertips, they have the extra laptop that their kid can use. They have, you know, and when they have that time, they're going to use it to research education or something that furthers their career. Whereas people who are not on the same side of that line are going to use it for entertainment. And if they're getting UBI, they're just using it to, you know, just get by, get the most calories at the cheapest price and not, it's the same thing of borrowing money to buy something that appreciates or borrowing money to like go on a vacation. So you still have the debt at the end of it, but you know, is it working for you or is it working against you? It's the same sort of dynamic that we're going here. And what Jesse talked about almost in passing, but it really kind of hit me, was a general strike, the prospect of a general strikes in the US. I mean, I've been thinking a lot lately about November. I really don't. And as a Canadian, I mean, typically we shouldn't care what goes on in another country's election, but we do this time.
But when it's the 800-pound gorilla that sleeps correct. Beside you.
You care. And so I've been thinking about it a lot. We've touched on it in this podcast the odd time. Is like, I really don't know how you even approach a semblance of normalcy this November for the election. And the idea that the elections are not going to go as they're supposed to go in the sense of just occurring. And the thought of a general strike, I mean, when I hear the word general strike, I think late 1980s Poland, you know, and East Germany and Warsaw Pact countries. I don't think Portland to Washington to New York to Orlando. I don't think general strike there. But when
that's
you said
historically
it,
where it happened 100 years ago.
Right.
150 years ago.
So, yeah. But it just jarred me of like, yeah, it could come to that. It may come to that. That could be where all this is heading. And I really don't know what to make of that.
It's part of the reason I think of a general strike was pandemic. Because pandemic was the closest thing we've seen to a total economic shutdown. Except it didn't come as a result of labor unions demanding the economy shut down. It came a result of governments being incompetent and not being prepared to handle a pandemic. But it resulted in the same effect, which is the economy shut down.
But do you think then that the let's call it the angst of the population, the general angst of the population, would it go in the same direction as what's been imposed on them, a de facto general strike? Or would it go in the opposite direction of like, we've had this sort of shutdown imposed on us, so a general strike wouldn't be a general strike as much as it might be a general sit-in or like takeover or general back-to-workness of like, you know, screw this, I'm going to go open my auto body shop and get back to work.
Okay, so there are foolish people attempting that. They're not going to succeed because they're stupid. Versus the other thing that we're seeing, which I think is on the same plane, is the revolt. And that's why I like the word revolt, because it's not a strike, because it's a lot of people who are now unemployed, and it's not organized by unions, so there isn't a leadership that you can negotiate with. But to your point, it's a lot of angst, and it's a lot of pissed off people who just don't know what to do. And, you know, that's where I think, to bring it back to where Charles started this, that's where I think the discussion of alternatives is interesting. Because it is in those moments historically that not just individuals, but societies are open to alternatives. And unfortunately, that's where the current president of the United States is offering an alternative, and it's authoritarianism, right? And he's telling all the people who he thinks will vote for him or support him, we have chaos, you need order, I am the man to deliver it. And that's dangerous. And to your point about Poland, that's what's happening in Poland right now. That's what's happening in Turkey. That's what's happening in the Philippines. That's what's happening all around the world. It, quote unquote, strong men are saying, in these times of turbulence, in these times of volatility, I will keep you safe. I will give you, you know, order. I will give you security. And that's why we need an alternative. We need to think about what the freedom-centric or reasonable, to use the notion of reason as a core principle, you know, what those alternatives are. Pre-pandemic, it was the world of decentralization that had the most compelling alternatives to offer people. I personally still believe that some of those alternatives are viable, but I'm not sure how the rest of the population is able to grok or understand or comprehend those alternatives now, amidst the stress of unemployment or the stress of these other things. But I also want to circle back in our now winding conversation to the notion of the universal basic income. Because that, I keep kind of nodding my head about, because I've always been an opponent of minimum income, because I think the issue is maximum income. And I think if we had a maximum income and then taxed the wealthy, that we would have tons of money for social programs that would actually help mitigate the effects of poverty. But I find it fascinating how the pandemic has radically shifted people's perceptions of a policy's viability, because now there are a lot of people saying universal basic income, let's do it. And here in Canada, we sort of have something close, right? We have this CERB, which is the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, where millions of Canadians are now getting $2,000 a month. And it's created, on the one hand, a lot of people saying, I like this, I want this to continue. But it's also created a lot of resentment. And it's created a lot of problems where, instead of working, people would rather just chill on their $2,000 a month. And so the government has just announced that they have another program called CEWS, Canadian Employment Wage Subsidy. And they want to push people from CERB to CEWS, because they're like, we want to give people this money, but we want them to be working and how we do it. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if they could do that, if they can accomplish that, if they can convince people that that free $2,000 a month is better earned in a job. But to finish comment, an interesting engagement with a local tradesman who I hired to teach me how to fix my garage door. And he was saying how their business has never been this busy, and they are backlogged with new garage door installs until October. And I was like, well, why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people are at home in the pandemic and they're fixing their homes? And he goes, no, it's that damn $2,000 a month. If you've got two people at home, that's $4,000 a month, and they're spending it on new garage doors. Terrible. To which I kind of had to sort of say, but they're giving you that money. They're installing garage doors with that money. Shouldn't you like this? Doesn't that benefit? And he couldn't get past his resentment. His envy of them getting that money while he worked prevented him from seeing that it was he who was the beneficiary of all that welfare money, because his business was booming. And it just struck me that the psychology of this is so silly, but at the same time, a legitimate part of the puzzle that we're dealing with.
It's kind of a profound, give me one second, Charles. It's kind of a profound misunderstanding of the broken window fallacy there, but I have to dispute you on 2 points there. One is we like to not overgeneralize things on this show. We've talked about that. So I don't think we can really dismiss people who are making the decision to reopen their businesses. A lot of these people don't have a choice. So not entirely fair to say, well, they're just COVID idiots or whatever, because if you got a choice between a pandemic that is like, for all we know, hang on,
So I misunderstood you, so I retract that. When I meant the idiots, I didn't mean business owners opening their business. I meant people going to bars and not wearing a mask. And businesses that are not adhering to proper guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, so like, people, if you're saying, like, people who are like, coronavirus is a hoax, let's go out and party. Yeah, okay, COVID idiots, right?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
But what I maybe I didn't articulate it. What I meant was people saying, like, almost a reverse strike of, like, I'm not staying shut down, I'm going to open up. And then everyone's going to, and that would, so I didn't know how to actually capture that. The other thing I had to almost physically restrain myself when you said maximum income, but so I have an obligation to state what I told a friend of mine. We were having a similar conversation a couple of weeks ago where I said, if there was no such thing of a bailout for any business for any reason whatsoever, and so the market worked out inefficiencies and people who blew themselves up, there would be less billionaires and there would be less wealth inequality. So I just really...
A valid point.
Yeah.
And you and I have just debated the maximum income previously, so we will again in the future. Let's throw to Charles.
Yeah, all right.
Well, what a great discussion here, and I'm trying to pare down all the possible things to comment on, but I sent you guys, I want to talk a little bit about the zeitgeist of the V-shaped recovery dying, you know, and I sent you guys a chart of the unemployment rate in the U.S., which is 21%, based on a very simple number. How many people are getting unemployment insurance? In other words, they lost their job, they lost their income, they qualify for unemployment at the state or federal level. Well, that number is 32 million people, which is roughly 21% of the workforce. A lot of people might not be counted in that. For instance, small business owners, unless you paid the unemployment insurance yourself on yourself, which most people don't, then you didn't qualify. So there's a lot of gray area there, it's probably more like 25%. So this is like Great Depression level of unemployment. In terms of a general strike or something similar, a general revolt, I would think that might be the driver. In other words, that's one of the drivers is, hey, we were all hoping everything would, you know, get back to normal. We, you know, Trump said it would all be done in April. We gave him a month extra, May. Things were picking up. House sales are going up. Yay, everything's back. Garage door installers and architects and contractors are all busy. Lumber's through the roof, you know. And so it's all like, yay. And then now it's like, well, wait a minute. Stuff's starting to roll over here in June. And so there's probably another wave of layoffs, right, coming up. And that may be part of the idea that the revolt could turn into the equivalent of a general strike. And this is where the UBI comes in because, well, guess what? The elites love UBI because it's like bread and circuses. Like, if we can just keep ownership of all the means of production and the political power, and all we have to do is print some money at zero cost and give it away to people, $2,000 a month, what an easy, wonderful solution. They're all quiet. They go back to being happy little consumers, and we get to own everything and control all the political mechanisms. And so this is partly, I think, why to Jesse's point, why the cultural acceptance of this is so overwhelming now is because the elites, it really works. And one of the things I often mention is, why does it work for the elites? Well, because then all those peasants getting the couple thousand a month can make their student loan payments, their credit card payments, and their auto loans. And believe me, there's going to be a restriction on getting the money if you don't make your debt payments. So
it's going to
debt serfdom
UBI
is
UBI like, is look, a landlord subsidy.
UBI is like it's going to be like a company script. Okay, so you say like the elites are going to own all the assets. It's all the equity is at the top end of the food chain. All the debt is at the bottom end of the food chain. The elites won't even use what the lower class identifies as money. They're going to have something else. They're going to have whatever, you know, and it's going to have expiry dates, right? You probably won't be allowed to save it. It's going to, you got to keep that money velocity up. You got to keep spending it. You got to keep that economy going. And it's really going to be a misnomer to even think of universal basic income as free money, because it's not going to be money. It's really going to be like food stamps or coupons or company script in one big company store.
Although that's what's interesting about the Canadian model, because it happened so quickly that it got ahead of the company store. Because I agree entirely with both of you in terms of, you know, the UBI as basically a subsidy for the current system. It reinforces the current system and it formalizes the serf. It formalizes the peasant in their position. And similarly, I think the opportunity for UBI becoming a company script, becoming a kind of a way in which you contain or control people spending within a particular conglomerate, I think that too is its direction. But again, the pandemic as a crisis forced this to happen. And I think that's why it's interesting to think about how it plays out. But at the same time, I mean, to your point, Mark, about, I mean, two of your points. One, that if the market was a true market and companies weren't bailed out, that you wouldn't have the same concentration of wealth that is there. I agree 100%. The same way that if you had antitrust policies that just enabled competition and prevented consolidation and prevented, you know, price control and some of the other things that oligopolies and monopolies do, that again, you'd have a more level playing field. I agree with you 100%. The problem is the nature of politics, the nature of corruption, is we never get to that point. And I think that's where you need a more either broader based literacy so that more of the voting public understands that stuff, so that they recognize that it's in their interest to vote for those laws. Or to your earlier point about business owners staging a kind of unstrike, I would love to see something similar, right? I would love to see the kind of what I would define as guerrilla capitalism, where small and medium-sized enterprises, instead of fearing each other, cooperated and started to recognize that there's power in numbers, that the original bourgeoisie was not, you know, large companies. They were small merchants who banded together to fight the aristocracy, to fight the monarchy, to fight for their rights. I think if you had something similar today where business owners not just worked with each other, but worked with their staff and worked with their customers and worked with their communities. And there are lots of small and medium-sized companies that do that. Right? In the United States, there's a big range. There's everything from B Corps, benefit corporations, to small companies like Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, who fundamentally do the right thing. And I think if there were more businesses that did that, that would make a better civil society. And that would make a better democratic society. So to bring back to your example, I would have loved to have seen businesses, you know, before even the official reopening happened, stand up and say, I've spent time to read the medical literature. I've spent time to follow the scientific research. I feel that this is an airborne disease and I'm gonna have everyone wearing masks. And I don't think surface sterilization is that important because there haven't been any transmissions, but I think physical distancing is important. So I'm gonna open up my store, I'm gonna demand that people wear masks, and I'm gonna have people line out the store so that it's not too much crowding in the store. And if businesses had done that before government told them to, they would get support. They would have credible authority. People are like, yeah, that's a business I can get behind. And ironically, that was one of the reasons why I went to Costco. Because Costco was one of the first big box stores that demanded a mask policy. and insisted that everyone coming into the store wear a mask. It's like, okay, I support that. I'm going to give them my dollars, even though they are a big box store, because I want to support companies that show that kind of leadership and really start to, you know, demonstrate to others the responsibility that's necessary in a pandemic. So I agree with that. I would see businesses that kind of lead, but it's really only small and medium-sized businesses that ever have the courage to do so. And it's usually only a minority of them that actually do it. So a whole other question would be, how do we facilitate more of that business innovation, that business resilience and politicization, so that they start playing a role in society along with everybody else?
Well, you're describing exactly what I was pushing for with my guerrilla capitalism blog and what I called the transition company, right? And that was my idea of companies that started to take a long-term view of things. And it was based on a premise that the credit super cycle was coming to an end. So, you know, and I wax philosophical on this often. So yeah, I mean, and you know, what I always said on the support guerrilla capitalism link on the blog was like, you know, I don't have a Patreon, I don't have a donate button. If you want to support guerrilla capitalism, then just direct more of your business towards independent and small companies, you know. And I always thought that if this, and maybe this is what an unstrike would look like, is more and more of these independent businesses would be starting to seek each other out and work with each other to develop a more of a grassroots ecosystem that responds to these kinds of situations. I don't know what's the matter with me today. I just completely lost my train of thought again. So over to you guys.
Although I'm not sure that unstrike is the right concept, because
yeah,
on the one hand, I could see businesses being part of a strike, because the thing about strikes is they do require infrastructure, right? And they do require what is essentially an alternate source of power, an alternate economy. So I could see businesses saying, I stand with the strikers, and I'm going to be on their side and support them and service them and open for them and only allow teachers into my store or only allow whatever into my... So there could be, there are solidarity scenarios where businesses are on the side of the strike versus, I think what you're describing is a network. And it gets back into our notion of the network society or the network state, that perhaps the future of independent, small and medium-sized businesses is to form networks of cooperation that are alternatives to digital platforms that allow them to scale up and do things that they couldn't do elsewhere.
Right, and let me break in here and say that that's exactly what we're talking about, is forming networks that are self-organizing. And kind of my whole idea with the Climb system was to set up like a really easy to use infrastructure for those people that wanted to self-organize this kind of cooperative network. They'd already have a structure they could just kind of join. And then it would be like, hey, this is so much easier than having to everybody trying to invent the wheel here. But there has to be an incentive. And that's where I think we're talking about, where small businesses, they now have an incentive to cooperate. Where before it was like, well, I'm taking a risk. I might lose my whole thing by trying to, you know, drop out of the status quo. Where now, if the status quo is crumbling away from you, then you have a huge incentive, like the parents who are self-organizing to hire a tutor. You know, there's now a huge financial and emotional incentive to do this, where before that it was lacking. To your point, Jesse, about the pandemic changing the whole situation. I also want to talk about class, because we're talking about the digital divide in class. And I want to refer back real quickly to the Vietnam War era, which is now ancient history for most people. But what happened there is kind of, there's a hidden history of that, is when there was a draft with a college deferment, the upper middle class kids got deferred because they could just stretch out their college and then they take it 6 years or whatever. And maybe the war ended, you know, before that, or if it didn't, then they would use their social capital network to join the Coast Guard or get some kind of, you know, National Guard thing like George W. Bush did to
Texas Air Guard, yeah.
Yeah, to evade becoming coming home in a body bag. Okay, so now, then when Nixon ended the deferments, then suddenly the upper middle class families were exposed to the fact that, their son could in fact end up, on the ground in Vietnam. And it's all like, well, wait a minute, this is like, what? And so then suddenly that changed from a bunch of wild-haired hippies trying to levitate the Pentagon to like a movement where people with political and economic power, changed their minds. When you talk about Portland, one of the first things that came to my mind was the families I know, our friends, and the kids who just graduated from college and used to work at a restaurant and made pretty good money on the tips, right? They have degrees in sociology or rhetoric or whatever, right? To the dysfunction that Mark spoke to about higher education, not really preparing you for real work. So then the restaurant and cafe, entertainment sort of sector was where people got jobs. Well, now they're all without jobs. And so many of them are in the front lines of the revolt. And so if you have a powerless working class neighborhood that rises up, nobody really cares if the police come in and stomp them or, whatever happens, right? But when the upper middle class kids are getting thumped or, their unemployment runs out, suddenly it's a real issue. And I think that's part of what could broaden this thing into a general strike is if it's only the, impoverished or politically powerless working class who's suffering, nobody cares. But when it's the upper middle class is suddenly impacted, it's like, well, now this is a real issue. And I think there's some of that, I think, manifesting.
So what's the catalyst then?
Let me quickly say, I met some of those cats who tried to levitate the Pentagon. And they were genuinely pretty radical, if not also spaced out.
No, I love that whole concept.
So what's the catalyst? What are the possible catalysts then that would actually galvanize the middle class into caring that, that this is a big deal?
I think Charles is right, that education. I think education is one of the key places in which the middle class, the upper middle class, even the lower middle class are kind of united because it's their hopes for their children. It's their belief that their children are going to get a better future. It's the idea that this is how their children get to have a crack at being part of the elite, get to, advance the family's fortunes. And I think as that becomes the clown show that we're expecting it to, as it starts to teeter on the brink, I think that combined with massive unemployment and then add a little sprinkle of fascistic police violence. And I think that's where you start to get your mass revolt cake.
That's the magic combo right there. Because especially in the U.S., education costs a fuck ton of money. Pardon my French. Not as much as Canada.
No, but technical then, so, term. Because right. That is the kind of money it costs.
So you spend that kind of money for each one of your kids to go through university and graduate into a jobless, automated, algorithmic, no employment society. And that is going to look pretty incendiary.
Although not to get off track, let me push back and say don't blame the machines. It's the humans who broke the economy. And the automation is not actually responsible for the loss of jobs. It's the sheer stupidity of the men who run a lot of these institutions.
Understood. But I need to tack on the thought that not only do your kids graduate into a job-ageddon, like a jobless society, they have non-dischargeable student debt.
Yes.
Piled to the moon.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think this is really interesting, and I know we're wrapping up our hour, but this whole idea of tipping point, flashpoint, where the complexity that Jesse, we started out discussing, that this is very complicated. Nonetheless, these dynamics can either self-reinforce, and then they build on themselves, and then they go from linear to nonlinear, and that's kind of like what we're talking about. And yeah, we're talking about education and our hopes for the future, and that's partly the UBI thing, which is, for a lot of people, it's like, okay, they get it. This is an emergency measure. But for them to sacrifice all their hopes and just to sort of get by, that's a step they're not yet willing to take. And so that's part of what we're talking about here is that desire for something more than just getting by,
Yeah. So and And let me flag for next time that we didn't get into TikTok today.
Yeah.
And we definitely should, because I think TikTok is a subtext to everything we've discussed today. Because TikTok is the non-American controlled social media that is the zeitgeist. And it is, you know, I use TikTok multiple times a day, mostly as a consumer. I don't yet upload to it because my internet sucks. But it's remarkable, given that we're in summer, how many kids are in total denial? How many people are in total denial? That, you know, we take granted, the three of us, that we follow the news, that we follow current affairs, that we've been paying attention to this pandemic. Most people are not. They got no clue what's going on, and they're just having their summer because they think the lockdown's over and now's the time to party. So the extent to which this is going to be a rude awakening for a lot of people, I think we underestimate, and I think it reinforces what we've discussed today and why I think we should talk about TikTok next week, or the week after, or whenever we are able.
I had my note on TikTok, which I'm not even going to quickly say now because it would take us to a whole new topic about just the nature of conflict. So,
I want to put in a word for the title, and I know it's always Mark always manages to come up with a good one.
I'm open to ideas.
You said Jobageddon. I think there's something. Although, if I had a similar thing for the whole educational institution, you know, imploding, that would even be better, maybe. But Jobageddon, that was a good one.
Well, I think that's it. Jobageddon and the collapse of education. Jobageddon. And, you know, the crash of the closing of school, and schools closed forever. Make a rip off that Alice Cooper song.
School's out forever. School's been blown to pieces.
School's out forever.
That's great. And then, Mark, you can link to that song on YouTube.
Yeah. And then we'll get demonetized for copyright violations again.
Yeah. No thanks. Yeah. Okay.
All right, guys. We will see you next week. I'm going to hit stop on the thing now.
Yep.